Once Donald Trump lost the election, he started his resistance network on Fox News. He's still peddling this lie that Bernie was assassinated. All right, hello there, and welcome to Owls at Dawn. We are just two dudes who grew up in Southern California. We traveled the world in order to study philosophy, politics, and religion. And at first, started a podcast in order to shit talk with impunity. But then thought better of it and decided politics is a dead end after the 2016 election, and that culture is all that matters. I'm Troy Polidori.
And I'm Austin Hayden Smith.
Yeah, as we all know, since politics really is downstream from culture, a lesson we learned in the past year, that after Trump came out and said that Beyonce should have won the Grammy for Best Album instead of Adele, that his ratings in the polls just tanked, and he lost the election. Clinton won the presidency in a landslide. And of course, very soon after that, Bernie Sanders was found dead at the bottom of a pool in a Holiday Inn. And the Great Purge finally happened of Bernie Bros, and they were all collected together, put in gulags, and sent to work. And the rest of us who learned our ways, and changed our ways, I should say, and learned to be good centrist liberals, had all of our civil and political energy sucked away from us. And so our podcast now is about culture, which is what it should have been all along. I mean, if we're going to be honest, right?
Yeah, just music, movies, books, a little poetry every now and then. That's about it. That's all I got life for.
Which is really how you actually change the world, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you watch a lot of TV and you listen to a lot of music and you talk a lot about it in really important terms.
Yeah, and you buy a lot of knickknacks through Amazon.
Yes, consumer politics. That's the only kind of politics that matters.
Consumer post-politics.
True.
Well, okay, so then let's just get into our episode as we always start every episode with our shitty minute. So, Troy, it's your turn this week. What do you got to rant about?
So my shitty minute is going to be about politics, but just a little bit. And I think it will be okay and we'll get past the censors. If not, then you'll never hear this or hear from me again. In which case, what are we going to do about that? So, as we all know, once Donald Trump lost the election, he started his resistance network on Fox News. And he's been ranting and raving as the new Glenn Beck since then, and combating his anti-Trump propaganda, calling the election fake news, the whole thing. And we're not really paying attention to it, right? But the really important thing is that he's still peddling this lie that Bernie was assassinated. He's the only one left who still believes this. I mean, everyone else still believes that's in the gulags, so you know, that's part of it. But they're there rightly so. And I just want people to stop focusing so much on who killed who or which group is purging others of their livelihoods, all these kinds of things, and realize that it's absolutely true and the medical reports have confirmed that Bernie just failed to realize that drinking Diet Coke straight from a 2-liter bottle while eating Mentos caused his heart to explode.
Yeah, I mean, facts are facts, right? And in this age, we understand when reports come out with medical information, we need to just let it be at that. So who am I to dispute a coroner's examination, you know? So I don't know, man. Plus, the dude was old as fuck, you know? Like, anything was going to tip him over the edge. I'm surprised he even made it through the campaign and he made it through the primaries. That was a lot of stress to put on that old dude. You saw his hair in his suits that he could barely fucking manage. Come on, man. You think that guy could handle some soda with some extra sugary content in there to give it that extra pop? Nope. It's like a seagull. Did you ever, when you were a kid, did you ever have friends? I never did this because I never tortured animals. But did you ever have those friends that were like, oh, if you give a seagull an Alka-Seltzer, that's Bernie. That's what happened.
What happens when you give a seagull Alka-Seltzer?
Oh, it expands and they have little tiny tummies and the Alka-Seltzer, you know, it bubbles up and it fizzes up. They burst and they die. So they eat the Alka-Seltzer and then they fly away and then they just drop out of the sky and they die.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, it's evil. It's like, you know, Sid from Toy Story, evil motherfucker shit that starts with torturing toys and then it graduates into seagulls and then you become a serial killer.
Wow.
Yeah, I never did it. I just had friends that did it and so I know about it because that's evil shit. But I'm making a comparison here between the poor seagull's belly and that old Jewish man.
Yeah, plus, man, only a fucking old guy like that's going to be able to, like, find Mentos. Where do you find Mentos nowadays?
Dude.
You probably had them stocked up since 1972.
Whenever I think of Mentos, I always think of the Dave Grohl, you know.
Foo Fighters song,
the Foo Fighters song, you know, that music video? And it was great. Like that parody. it's so good. I know.
The Foo Fighters is the great American band right now. We can all agree on that, right?
Yeah, you know, I had some friends that were just at a Ghost concert. Do you like Ghost at all?
Oh, I fucking love Ghost.
Oh, do you? Okay, so my friends saw Ghost in Glasgow at O2, and I was reading a little bit on Ghost, and apparently Dave Grohl actually secretly dressed up as one of the, what are they called again? The ghouls, the nameless ghouls?
Oh, it's Papa Emeritus, and then, yeah, I think they're just called the Ghouls.
The Ghouls, yeah, the Nameless Ghouls. I think Dave Grohl actually performed as a drummer one time as a Nameless Ghoul. So I was like, ah, that's kind
of
cool.
There's all sorts of rumors that, like, every famous rock and metal musician has played with them at some point.
Oh, really?
Guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like the cool thing now.
Oh, that is.
But that would be awesome if Dave Grohl did, though. That'd be totally cool.
Mm-hmm.
So for our main segment this week, as we said earlier, politics is downstream from culture, and there's no point in talking about politics right now, at least not unless we guise it or, you know, put it into the sort of guise of culture itself. So we're going to talk about that meme that's been going around for the past couple of weeks, our favorite movies every year since we were born, which will be riveting, I'm sure.
First, before we get into it, I need to give a big hearty fuck you to you for sending me over a template that started in 1986. Thanks, Dick.
Oh, shit, yeah.
You're trying to
I forgot about that.
You trying to remind me that I'm older than you? Thanks, bro.
Would I have to make a template just for you? What if I put it, like, starting at 1978? That would have been funnier.
Yeah, then it would have been. So does this mean that I have, like, unfettered choices before you jump in here? That I just have to kind
of,
like.
You do. You get a couple of your own goes here.
Okay. All right. So let me get my list up here. All right. So, 1983. I mean, this is, to me, I know so many people hate this of the three in the trilogy that were originally released, but it was my favorite when I was a kid because those Ewoks were badass. Return of the motherfucking Jedi. 1983.
Okay, is it your least favorite Star Wars movie, though, of the first three?
Oh, yeah, of course. But,
okay.
But
that's okay.
But now here, I have to say this. My list is going to be a little bit. It's going to be a little bit scattered because some of the choices are choices because I watched them at the time, and some of them are like childhood films, and then some of them are films that I've seen more recently, but I've seen them in the past. So it's like they're kind of confused, you know? So
I'm the same way, yeah. Some of them are like pop movies, some of them artistic, and it's all over the place.
It's mine all over the place. Okay. And then the reasons for liking them, some of them are because I liked them when I was 10, and some of them are because I liked them now. Okay, so cool. So 1984, then, this is one of those I like it now, is Love Streams by John Cassavetes.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, it's one of his later films. It's really his kind of like last, or they say it's like his penultimate film, but it's like his last true film, and it's really good. It's great. So it stars him and his wife, Gina Rowlands, as brother and sister, actually. But very good. Very good. 1985.
All I can think of with Cassavetes really quick is that Fugazi song about Cassavetes.
I don't know it.
There. Yeah.
Oh, I don't even know it. I'd have to hear it. It's not about Nick Cassavetes and The Notebook, right?
What?
Nick Cassavetes and The Notebook? It's not that Cassavetes that they're singing about, right?
No. It's filmmaker Cassavetes.
No. Nick Cassavetes is a filmmaker. He wrote. Or
oh, he is?
John Cassavetes' son directed The Notebook.
Oh, the Brian Gosling one?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. No, it's definitely not. They did this in the early 90s before that came out.
Okay. All right. So 1985 is a movie called Real Genius starring Val Kilmer. Did you ever see that?
I haven't seen that one either. What is that?
Yeah, it's like Val Kilmer is this prodigy science whiz who does work on like lasers and shit like that. And then there's this other young prodigy who's like 14 or 15, and he goes to this technical university and he's paired with Val Kilmer. But Val Kilmer, who's this genius, has kind of burnt out on being a genius, and he's partying a little bit, and he wants the younger kid to kind of loosen up. And then the younger kid wants Val Kilmer to go back to his genius ways because he used to be this child prodigy. And so then they get commissioned to work on this project together, and it's just about the antics that they go through. But when I was a kid, man, I fucking loved that movie. Loved it.
I've never heard of this movie before, although it sounds a bit like what you'll be in 10 years.
Yeah, probably. Probably. So, okay, so now that we've caught up and we're at 1986, I'll let you have the first go.
All right, 1986, my favorite movie was The Fly, Cronenberg's version.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Brundlefly, man. That movie, I saw that in college, and I'd seen a lot of horror movies, obviously, but I hadn't seen some of those kind of 80s gross-out ones.
Sure.
Like Cronenberg does. It was the first Cronenberg movie I ever saw. And it freaked the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
The scene when he's turning into the fly and then he arm wrestles with some dude at a bar. Like, that was one of the grossest things I think I'd ever seen.
Hmm. Yeah, I think – so David Cronenberg is one of my buddies. He's a director. His name's Andy Stewart. It's his favorite director, and I believe The Fly is actually – if it's not his favorite, it's one of his favorite horror films of all time. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's like second or third for me.
Is it? Right on. My 1986 choice is Top Gun. Now, this is my favorite movie.
There's a Val Kilmer obsession going on here.
Oh, you have no idea. It's not. It doesn't end here either, let me tell you. But Top Gun is my favorite movie of all time. And I say this as a child. My grandpa worked on the movie. You know, he was stationed at Miramar. Yeah, he was one of the consultants to help the Flyboys and stuff like that. So, but I was obsessed with Top Gun from when I was a kid. I wanted to be a fighter pilot because I wanted to be like my grandpa, and I wanted to be like Maverick and Iceman and shit. So Top Gun was my favorite movie from when I was a little boy. And I mean, I would still say it's my favorite movie of all time just because it was my favorite for so long. So Top Gun, 1986, Tony Scott, the best Tony Scott film ever.
I'm probably the same way with Space Jam, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Makes sense.
All right, so 1987, mine is Evil Dead 2.
Evil Dead 2?
2 is the best Evil Dead. It's not even close.
I haven't even seen it.
Evil Dead 2?
No.
Are you sure you haven't seen Evil Dead 2 and think it's Evil Dead 1?
Maybe.
It's the more famous one for sure.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the one where Bruce Campbell loses his arm and puts the chainsaw on and the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I've seen it.
Yeah, so Evil Dead 2 is brilliant. It's gory. It's Sam Raimi just giving no fucks.
Right.
It's amazing. That's, I mean, all the shots of the camera, I don't know what you call it, where the camera's low to the ground, mm-hmm. and it's running through the woods,
mm-hmm.
like some demon. That's just like the coolest shot in horror movie history.
Yeah.
It has to be.
All right, so my 1987 choice is totally fucking stupid and ridiculous, but again, it was one of my favorite movies from when I was a kid. Mannequin, starring Kim Cattrall and Andrew McCarthy.
I don't know that one either.
Dude. So it's like this woman in Egypt gets cursed or some shit like that, and she becomes a mannequin in a store, you know, like a store mannequin, and mm-hmm. she can only come to life in the presence of someone, and I think it's because it's like they're meant to be or some shit like that. And so somehow she comes to life whenever Andrew McCarthy is around, and then it's about her trying to become fully human again, and she can only do that with Andrew McCarthy and somehow and shit like that. And she does, and it's got that what's that song that, and we can build this dream together, standing strong forever. No, was that Jefferson Starship?
That sounds like every like a gospel song.
Nothing's gonna stop us now, and if this world runs out of lovers, we'll still have. Yeah, so that's the closing credit song. But that was one of my jams when I was a kid. So
this sounds like a parody of 80s movies right now.
I know. All right, 88.
88 for me is My Neighbor Totoro.
What the fuck is that?
It's anime. It's okay. Miyazaki from Studio Ghibli.
Yeah.
One of his more famous films. And I'm not a huge like anime fan or anything, but I saw this movie only 4 or 5 years ago.
Hmm.
And I had no idea what to expect. I just knew it was very critically acclaimed and beloved by a lot of people. And it like wrecked me.
Hmm.
It was just gorgeous, beautiful film. I don't care if you're 80 years old, 60 years old, whatever you are. Watch My Neighbor Totoro, and it's brilliant.
My Neighbor Totoro. Wow.
It's like a it's a kids movie, but if it doesn't matter, kids of all ages, literally every age, will love this movie. It's great.
You know what? I've never actually seen one of his films.
Oh, wow. It's going to make a couple appearances here. But there's a cat bus, man.
What's a cat
bus? Bus. It's a cat bus. It's a bus. It's a cat. It's just a great, sort of analogy, or allegory, I should say, for suffering. A child going through emotional suffering. It's beautiful. And, like, you know Pan's Labyrinth, which will make an appearance later?
Mm-hmm.
It's Pan's Labyrinth, like, 15 years before Pan's Labyrinth.
Okay. Huh. I'll have to check it out then.
But you should definitely watch it, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like already in the 80s here, except for Love Streams, my choices are going to be very superficial, whereas yours might have a little bit more of an artistic, and then I think I'm going to make up for it at the end. But
wait, because I'm younger than you, so in the 90s, I'm going to have this experience. All these 80s movies, I wasn't alive yet, so
yeah,
I couldn't.
Yeah, that's true.
I wasn't old enough yet, yeah. You'll see.
All right, so 88. 88 is a movie that actually isn't even a good movie, and I haven't seen it since I was probably like 7 or 8 years old. But it was Willow. The Ron Howard directed Willow, starring Val Kilmer, Warwick Davis, and Joanne Whalley, however you say her name. And fuck, man. I wanted to be Mad Mardigan so bad when I was a kid. I used to have action figures. I had Willow action figures. And I used to, like, you know, some people have G.I. Joes. I had G.I. Joes too. But I also had Willow action figures. And Mad Mardigan was my jam, dude. He was the greatest swordsman that ever lived. So, Willow.
Was Willow, like, the one fantasy movie that was okay for conservative evangelical Christian households?
Well, see, I wasn't in a conservative Christian household at that point.
Neither was I, but
so I don't know.
I get that impression somehow.
Oh,
I
do
haven't
you?
Seen it since I was a kid.
I don't know. There's like sorcery and shit.
Is there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Warwick Davis.
I don't remember.
His whole thing is he's a little sorcerer. He wants to be a powerful sorcerer. And the evil Bavmorda, I can't remember how you say her name, but she is a sorceress. And she's fucking evil. And she turns all the soldiers into pigs and shit like that. And Willow, he has a whole segment of scenes when he has to turn this one really powerful sorceress who was like exiled on an island and she's a rat. And he has to try to get her back to her human form so that they can help take over this evil queen sorceress, Bavmorda. So, yeah, a lot of sorcery and dark shit. It's pretty dark, man. I don't know if a lot of those evangelical households would find it to be too super safe.
And that reminds me of the fantasy movie that was always okay was The Princess Bride. But they never got that it was ironic. Like, they thought this was an appropriate and accurate telling of like courtship. And not just completely ironic the whole time. Yeah, that always kind of bugged me.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's actually one of my favorite movies of all time. And I didn't put it on the list. I completely forgot about that film. So whatever year that came out, add that to the list.
That's somewhere on there.
Yeah.
All right. So 1989 for me is Jesus of Montreal.
Oh yeah.
Which is actually
I just recently saw
that. Last year for the first time saw it.
Yeah.
And it's become one of my favorite movies since then. It's a French Canadian film about a theater actor who is going to direct a passion play for the Catholic Church on Jesus, and he decides to do it really artistically and represent it with modern culture, and then he ends up living through an allegory of the Passion itself, with the Catholic Church replacing the Jewish leaders as the conspirators. Yeah. And it's a really beautiful film. It hits every button I have. It's artistic. It's politically liberal. It takes religion seriously. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I got to see that one. I haven't seen that one yet. So, I know you told me about it, and I haven't checked it out, but I really do want to see it because it sounds right up my alley. So,
1989, what you got?
All right, 1989, James Cameron's The Abyss.
You like that film?
Dude, when I was a kid, I was fucking obsessed with it.
Isn't it like 4 hours long?
Probably, but I was fucking obsessed with it when I was a kid. I think I wanted to be an adventurer. At one point, after I wanted to be a fighter pilot, and then my grandpa said, no, you don't want to be a fighter pilot. And then I was like, are you sure? He's like, yeah, trust me, you don't want to be a fighter pilot. And I was like, okay. I think I've always had an adventurous spirit, and the idea of them going down into the bottom of some random oceanic trench just seemed so amazing. Now, I think the ending, now that I see it as an adult, I think the ending is whack as fuck, but it's interesting, I think, up until the ending. And then as a child, my memories of the film actually kind of stop at the ending. Particularly the last bit when, like, the city of Atlantis surfaces or whatever the fuck it is. That's just stupid. But I don't even – I, like, block that out mostly in my memory, my childhood memories of this film. It's mostly just about John Bean or Michael Bean and him, you know, trying to sneak a nuclear warhead and the tensions and Ed Harris having that suit where he's like sucking in liquid. And as a kid, I just thought that it was so fucking interesting and imaginative and big. And so it just seems so interesting. I've always been fascinated with under the ocean things. It's like in The Spy Who Loved Me, the James Bond film, how they've got that underwater kingdom and, you know, the car turns into an underwater submarine. I've always loved that kind of shit. So I loved The Abyss when I was a kid.
Man, no wonder you liked Westworld. It's just some connection with Ed Harris when you were a kid.
Probably.
Like your movie daddy. 1990 for me, here's where I get to be a kid and can actually watch movies. Tremors with Kevin Bacon.
Oh, dude, I love Tremors.
I have seen this movie probably more times than I've seen any other movie in existence. I used to watch
it. What the hell is that smell?
Kevin Bacon is so good in this movie. He's playing Kevin Bacon, but it's fantastic. And I forget the name of the other guy.
I love Reba McEntire.
Oh, yeah.
Her and her husband, how they have that bunker.
It's so fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, the other guy Bert and whatever Reba's character's name is. But yeah, what's the co-star?
Yeah, I forget his name, but he's the grizzled veteran, right? And he's fantastic in it. It's a brilliant campy B horror film. It's the perfect kind of B horror film. Like if you wanted to just spend an hour and a half wasting away time and just having a popcorn, eating popcorn or whatever, this is the exact movie you'd want to have on.
Yeah.
And they made like 7 sequels.
Yeah, I think I've only seen the first 2, but I love Tremors. That is such a good choice, man. That's a great film. All right, my 1990 film is Edward Scissorhands, Tim Burton, Johnny Depp, Winona Ryder. So we know this because we lived in Santa Clarita, but the legend was because Tim Burton went to Cal Arts that Edward Scissorhands was about him when he was at Cal Arts, and that the sort of pastel-y, cookie-cutter town, suburbs that Edward is, he infiltrates and then is shunned from, was the suburbs of Santa Clarita. Now, I don't know how true that is, but, I mean, it seems to make some sense.
I'll go with very true.
You think so?
I mean, even if it wasn't intended, it's still true.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because even Johnny Depp's hair looks like Tim Burton's hair. All wild and crazy and shit. So, and I think Tim Burton does kind of fancy himself as a sort of eccentric artist that, at least at the time, you know, was a bit of an outcast. And definitely in Valencia, he would be an outcast. So, yeah, Edward Scissorhands, love that movie.
There's nothing like casting, like, one of the hottest guys in the world to play you. And to play you as a very, very attractive, ugly person. All right, 1991 for me is Terminator 2, which, actually, now that I think of it, I may have seen more times than Tremors. It's possible.
Dude, that's my choice for 1991.
Oh, there we go. You can talk about it. So that Terminator 2 is like the greatest action movie ever made, right?
It's fucking amazing, bro.
It's got to be like Die Hard and Terminator 2 are the like neck and neck for that battle.
Now, here's the thing. I watched it. So if it came out in 91, I watched it in probably 92 or 93 on VHS in my aunt's condo, and my dad was so mad at her. Because now that was after he converted. So now at this point, now it was an evangelical house. Even though like my parents were split, I lived with my mom, but I would see my dad on the weekends. But I remember I told my dad I watched this movie, and he was so mad at my aunt. Not his sister, though. It's my mom's sister. So there was kind of, you know, disconnect. It's not like he had any sort of authority over what she did. But he was so upset that she let me watch that movie. I fucking loved it.
You should have just argued it was an allegory for like being a prophet.
Yeah.
The prophets are always chosen, and they're like, they're not able and they can't speak. They're like John Connor, but then they have to just suck it up and do it anyway.
Yeah. When you go to Calvary Chapel, I don't think that sort of artistic relevance really works.
Well, then current you can go back in time and tell, like, 9-year-old you or whatever to do this.
Well, technically, if time travel does exist, then it probably has already happened, right? So then I'm just going to say, future me, during this podcast, show up and tell me if you have done this.
Unless it creates alternate timelines. Like, there's a whole thing here. Oh, yeah, primer, point. Right? Primer explains this.
A good point. That was almost on my list. Actually, did I put it on my list? No, I... Yeah, oh, well, maybe I did. All right, 92.
For me is Dead Alive.
Which good
is one
film.
One of Peter Jackson's first films. It's a horrifically gross-out horror movie.
Yeah.
But it's fantastic. And there's a scene where a guy is fighting like 50 zombies with a lawnmower, which is one of the greatest scenes in horror movie history. There's also like a zombie baby, which gets in a fight with a blender, which is pretty amazing too.
Yeah, he made it for like next to nothing too, with pennies, and the practical effects are just fun. They're not always great, but they're fun.
Yeah, it's super campy, but they're all super practical, campy. Which is the best part about it.
Exactly, yeah. No, that's great, man. It's so funny to think that he came from that to making some of the biggest scale CGI films ever made.
Yeah, like who would have thought, like, watched Dead Alive and be like, yeah, this guy should handle Tolkien. That just makes no sense.
Yeah. I would love it if you took somebody that doesn't know anything about it and you show them, you know, Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit, and then you show them Dead Alive and you say, same dude. Same dude. People would be like, no. All right, my 1992 film was The Last of the Mohicans.
Oh, great film.
Fucking love this movie. This was
Daniel
the first time.
Day.
Yeah, this is the first. This is the first Daniel Day appearance on my list, but it won't be the last. And this was the first time that I was ever exposed to him as an actor. And I remember I saw this when I was young, and this was one of my dad's favorite films when he was younger. So I saw it when I was quite young, and there was something magnetic about Daniel Day-Lewis that has started to wear off in recent years for me personally. But this film is probably my favorite Daniel Day-Lewis performance, actually. As interesting as that sounds, with so many amazing performances, My Left Foot and In the Name of the Father, and obviously There Will Be Blood, and, you know, he's done some amazing performances. But for some reason, this one just sticks with me the most because it's a little bit simpler, I feel, you know? Although he does that with some of his other films too. But for the most part, I would say 80-20, he tends to like to err to the side of like overperforming, the bravura performances. And this one's much more subtle.
And even most relevant is, it just came out a few weeks ago, right, that Daniel Day-Lewis's next incredible challenge is to play Hillary Clinton in the biopic about the 2016 election called Triumph of the Will.
Yeah, and it's going to be
impressive, him in a pantsuit.
It's going to be amazing. He's going to look great in a pantsuit. And not only that, but I think it's going to be interesting that people are going to have to call him Madam President on set constantly, since that's what he does.
That's right. He's going to have to be Hillary Clinton all day, every day.
They're like, Mr. Lewis, I'm sorry, Madam President. Yeah. And with how he's already played one president and he did the voice perfectly, it's going to be interesting to see the amount of time that he spends crafting her dulcet tones.
1993 for me is Groundhog Day.
Oh, I almost chose it. I almost chose it.
Groundhog Day. Bill Murray in Groundhog Day has to be the most charming performance in American movie history, right? Like, it's up there with all Jimmy Stewart's performances.
Mm. Yeah, I don't disagree.
You can't watch that and not love the lovable, adorable, creepy, kind of douchebaggy Bill Murray.
Yeah. And to be honest, I think this, for me, was the first time that I was introduced to him as a serious actor. And he actually is a phenomenal actor. That one scene when they're in the cafeteria and he's talking about how he knows everything and he's predicting, he's like, I know everything. A waiter's going to drop a tray of dishes in 5, 4, 3, 2, and the dishes fall over. And Andy McDowell is like, okay, that's enough, you know? And they kind of go down over to the desk and they sit down. And he starts talking about how she's like, well, what about me? Do you know me? And he starts going off about how there's a boat in the dock and, you know, there's like planks that you go under and shit like that. His ability to kind of switch from sort of comedic, you know, kind of almost mean and curt to funny and humorous to serious is effortless. And it's really lovely in a very sort of simple script. I love that movie. Great movie.
Yeah. It's the thing is, it's such a simple idea and such a popular film. And yet it's also has depth.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the perfect example of how you'd make a philosophical film with a pop for a popular audience. Like, it's exactly what you should do. It's the template.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree. Is that a Harold Ramis film?
I don't remember. It certainly seems like it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great one. See, I almost chose that, but I decided to go with this other one because this one had more of a hold over my childhood. I actually saw this movie at a drive-in movie theater for the first time in 1993. Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
Oh, such a great film.
I saw it at a drive-in. I think that – I don't even remember where the drive-in was. It might have been in Santa Fe, you know, Santa Fe Springs in California there.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It might have been there. It's kind of like right on the border of Orange County and Los Angeles, for those of you that are wondering. And it may have been there, but since then, I can't even tell you how many times I watched it. Because, you know, we had the VHS version, and I watched it on repeat viewings many, 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 many times over.
Yeah, Men in Tights was the first PG-13 movie I got to see.
Mm.
So what was it, 93?
Yeah, so you would have been
like
seven.
So I was like eight, seven or eight. Yeah, yeah. So... yeah, it had a huge impact on me. And who was the woman who played Maid Marian?
I don't know her, the actress.
The redhead?
Name. Yeah.
But yeah, I was like 9 years old and in love with her. It was probably the first like mention of sex I saw in a movie. So it was like,
I was going to say that about the sort of strawberry red girl in Tremors. When I was younger, I was like, that is it. That is my future wife. Her and Amy Grant were vying for my attention.
Oh my God.
All right, 1994, dude.
94 for me is a first, and I think only documentary on here.
Don't even
Hoop Dreams.
No shit, dude. Mine too.
Really?
That's my 94 film.
I thought, no way. I didn't even know you saw Hoop Dreams.
Oh, bro, I devoured
the best basketball
that book.
Film.
I
best
devoured.
Basketball movie.
Oh, such a good basketball film. Did you read the book too?
No, I did not read the book.
I think the book was made after the documentary, but okay. I devoured. That's like one of the only books I remember. God, I must have been 11 or 12. I remember reading it, like sneaking, reading this book in class when other stuff was going on, but I wanted to read this book. It's one of the first times that I remember something engaged me so much that I wanted to do my own reading above and beyond what they were teaching me at school. And it was that book. But yeah, dude, that documentary, Arthur Agee, William Gates.
And like, I mean, I loved basketball so much as a kid, so that obviously draws you in.
Yeah.
But just the story of the two kids trying to make it. And it's pretty amazing to think about. You know, neither of them made it, obviously.
Mm.
But that didn't affect the movie at all. And that shows that the depth of the film was so much more than just that.
Hmm. Yeah, a fucking great movie, man. Yeah, so that's two we have of the same one. We should have done an over-under to see how many we would get.
Okay, over-under five by the end of it.
I'm going to say under.
I'll say over.
Okay. Okay, I'm gonna say we'll get to four.
Okay, four and a half then. We'll say over, under. I'll say over, you say under.
Under. Okay, perfect. Perfect. Okay.
All right, 95.
95.
For me, 12 Monkeys.
Ooh, good movie.
I love this film. One of the best sci-fi films probably ever made. Bruce Willis is fantastic in it.
Yeah.
Brad Pitt has his best role ever.
Yeah.
Ever in this, and he just goes nuts, and it's perfect. One of the few occasions where overacting was called for.
Mm-hmm.
And so it actually fit really well.
Yeah, because it fits with the tone of the film. So,
absolutely.
So it's okay.
Just,
yeah.
Terry Gilliam's skewed, I don't know what you call it when you skew every shot, so it's off kilter. But you know, he's kind of he did it in Brazil and he does it here, and it fits perfectly with the whole. You feel disoriented the whole time you're watching the film,
mm-hmm.
which is appropriate because that's the way it's shot. And yeah, it's a very effective film.
Yeah, yeah, very good film. 95. Now this was because I saw this movie in the theaters and I was 12 at the time. And I remember the line was insanely long and it was at a movie theater that my dad, that his contracting company had helped build, which was called, the Irvine Edwards 21 at the Irvine Spectrum in Orange County. Shout out to the suburb yuppies. Toy Story. Ugh. That movie, it was like revolutionary to me. I remember seeing it and I couldn't – the line, dude, I'd never been to a movie where you had to stand in line for hours just to get tickets. So now I know other people in their history had done that. But for me, this was the first time that I did that, that I stood in line for ages to get tickets. And we saw Toy Story and the huge IMAX screens at the Edwards 21 in Irvine. And so that was – fucking just insanely impactful. And I just thought it was, it's a great movie, man. It's really well done. And it kind of revolutionized the history of animated films.
Yeah, it was the first completely computer-generated animated film, right, I believe?
Yeah, feature-length, yeah.
Feature-length, yeah.
Yeah. Because I think it was Roly Poly Oly was a short that they did, and I believe that was the first of its kind, but it was a short. So I believe that Toy Story was the first feature. All right, 96, brother.
96, for me, is the first of many Coen Brothers films, Fargo.
Yeah.
I mean, what else do you have to say about Fargo? Just watch the movie. It's brilliant. It's a tour de force. It's one of the best dramas, thrillers ever made. Everything about it is perfect. Steve Buscemi. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, it's great. I considered it, but I had to go with the film that actually had more of an impact on my life, probably to my detriment and to the detriment of every person that has known me that is of the opposite sex, but Swingers.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah,
Vince
mean,
Vaughn.
And Jon Favreau, you know, your money, baby. You're money, you don't even know it.
Little did we know Vince Vaughn was playing Vince Vaughn in that film.
I know. That's exactly right, man. But he did this thing in Swingers that he has now replicated in various other films where he likes to compare a character to an animal. So there's this bit where they're in this club and Jon Favreau is hesitating to go over and talk to Heather Graham, I believe. And Vince Vaughn says, dude, you're like this big fucking bear, man, with these big claws. And you're looking at this bunny in front of you. And you're like, how do I kill the bunny? I don't know how to kill the bunny with these big fucking paws, man. And he's like, but you can do it. You can just go kill the bunny because you're a big fucking bear with these huge claws. And then the dude next to him is kind of like, yeah, man, he's a bear. And Vince Vaughn has subsequently done animal comparisons through various other films. And it was interesting. But yeah, man, Swingers was huge. When I was like 19 or 20, my buddies and I used to always use the phrase, act like you need the shit, you get the or act like you don't need the shit, you get the shit for free, which is obviously extremely fucked up, but, you know. But, yeah.
So this is like your sexual urtext.
Yeah, this is my sexual urtext. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Confessions with Austin again. All right, 1997. This has a cool story behind it. Okay. I'll get through pretty quickly here. Life is Beautiful with Roberto Benigni.
Yeah.
I was 11 years old, and Life is Beautiful came out, and my parents wanted to see it, and I wanted nothing to do with a Holocaust movie, drama in a foreign language. It was like everything I would not want to see. And I don't remember what movie. It was some other like cartoon or something else that was out that I really wanted to see. And I like threw a hissy fit, which is not normal for me as a kid, and really was upset. But eventually they dragged me to it and did the whole, we promise you'll like it kind of thing.
Hmm.
And I had never seen a film like that before. And Roberto Benigni is just entrancing in that role, especially when you're like 11 or 12. So I was in the place of his child
right.
In the film and had never seen really a depiction of the Holocaust like that. And so I hadn't seen Schindler's List yet. I wasn't old enough. And I can't remember where I was or any of that, but I can remember the feeling of that film. Like, it was probably the first time I ever actually, like, teared up in a film as a child.
Hmm. Yeah, I think
I saw...
As a young man. Yeah, I saw Life is Beautiful in school, actually, for the first time. I think in a history class or, like, a poli-sci class or something like that. My 1997 choice is Gross Point Blank. I fucking love this movie, man. I love John Cusack. I love Minnie Driver. Actually, as weird as it might sound, in terms of acting performances, for some reason, there is something so subtle and so nice about John Cusack, Minnie Driver, and Jeremy Piven's acting performances in this film that I think are so understated because they're so simple. Because we are so used to praising like the Daniel Day-Lewis's and the Sean Penn's and the Marlon Brando's, the big, huge moments, you know, tears streaming sort of performances. But John Cusack and Jeremy Piven have like this just really simple, relaxed. I mean, granted, they were best friends anyway, so that's basically just them being friends with a camera pointed at them. But I just fucking loved it. I thought it was really nice, and it's a simple film, but I fucking loved it. I still love it.
Yeah, good memories of that film for me too.
Mm-hmm.
98, my favorite movie of all time. You know it. Everyone who knows me knows it. The Big Lebowski. I have every line memorized. I know every scene. I've seen it probably 300 million times. It was on repeats constantly in college,
yeah.
In my apartment.
Yeah. Every time in Glasgow, there's a bar slash restaurant that's called Lebowski's. And I think I've probably taken screenshots of their menu like 3 or 4 times because all of their white Russians that they serve, which are
you said that to me
30.
One time, I remember,
I think I've sent them a couple times. They're all named like the Jesus or Nihilist, you know?
Nobody
so they
fucks
all have
with the Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. Or the dude. So the toe is another name of the drink. So every drink that they have, every white Russian that they have is themed after the film. So, yeah.
Can we just say the movie that makes like John Goodman, his career, like the greatest role he's ever had? It's got to be Walter.
Oh, maybe the greatest role he's ever had. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I don't know if that's what made his career, though. Roseanne, right?
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Roseanne was legit. He was in people's living rooms. They were getting 25, 30 million people a week. I mean, can you imagine the ratings? Now you're lucky if you get 20 million. Roseanne, it was like 25, 30, 35 million viewers a week is what they were getting. Because you didn't have many options. But yeah, man. So that was probably the film that made his career. But yeah, man, definitely his best performance.
And Jeff Bridges, obviously. Nothing, fantastic. You have to say more about that. Yeah.
No.
What's your 98 film?
Enemy of the State. Another Tony Scott film with Will Smith and Gene Hackman. Yeah. Now, I know this isn't exactly considered a great film, especially even in kind of like the au revoir of Tony Scott. But, God, I fucking loved this movie. Now, this was a film I saw when I was 15 years old. And I think I snuck into the theater with a buddy of mine because it was one of those – we used to do the thing where you buy a ticket and then you like hop from – so you buy one ticket but you can go see like two or three films. And I believe this was one of the ones that we snuck into because I remember there was a sense that like we were doing something really special. You know, like I thought we were really cool, fucking 15 years old, sneaking into the movies and seeing Enemy of the State. But I fucking loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Dude, remember when we had time to go see 2 or 3 movies in a row?
Yes. All right, 99.
99 for me, Fight Club. It was hard. This one was hard. There were a few ones that were difficult for me to choose from. I'm not sure I like this movie as much now as I did then in retrospect, but then it was everything.
Well, this is number 3 then because – or this is our third, I should say, film that we've chosen because Fight Club for me was the 99 film. Yeah, and same. It was about that time. Like I went through a stage where I wanted to dress like Brad Pitt and I wanted my body to look like Brad Pitt's, you know, in that poster, the famous picture of him. And I was like, that is what a man's body. I'm going to do that. I'm going to work out so hard and that's going to be my body.
And did you realize that the very movie itself was critiquing your wanting to be that?
Yeah, but I didn't realize it when I was 16.
That was the thing, right? Like in college, we had fight clubs in dorm rooms. And it was like, does no one here understand that the movie is actually leveling a heavy critique against your desire to do these things?
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, okay, never mind. I wonder what Fight Club's legacy is going to be, though. In like 30 years or so with the whole alt-right ideas and all that stuff kind of taking a lot of the Fight Club anti-SJW stuff with it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's got kind of that sort of anarchist bent, right, where they blow up the credit cards at the end and it kind of – what's the fucking TV show with the hackers?
Mr. Robot?
Yeah, thank you. It's kind of Mr. Robot-y, right? I remember actually when I first watched Mr. Robot, I was like, oh, this is kind of a ripoff of Fight Club, right? You know, they're attacking the large corporation and the idea is that they can reset credit balances and things like that. But, you know, there's that anarchist bent that I think was kind of appealing to me as a teenager when I was, you know, I was in a punk band at the time. And so, you know, it was kind of influential to me for a long time.
It's still just an absolutely great film.
Yeah.
Even if it's going to have a complicated legacy, it's a great film. And Edward Norton and Brad Pitt are fantastic in it.
Yeah, so
and so
good.
Is
Helena Bonham Carter.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Oh my gosh, she's so good
she's
in it.
She's great. Yeah, she's great. All right, so my... Oh, 2000. I have a feeling we might actually have the same one.
So I have a tie here.
Oh.
And it's okay to have a tie if both are top 10 films of all time. It's okay to have a tie.
Okay.
I feel like.
Okay.
I'll choose if I have to. But it's Memento.
Okay.
On one hand. Mm-hmm. And Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
All right.
And if I had to choose, it'd be Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, but it was really hard because they're both top 10 films of all time for me.
The only reason I'm worried is because my 2000 film is Memento. And
well, it counts as a tie then.
And then that make that – okay. And then that gives us 4. And so now I'm worried that my over-under is in jeopardy with 15 years to go.
Okay. I mean, Memento is got to be one of the most interesting and mindfucky films.
Yeah.
That's not a pure art film at least.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite films of all time.
It's trying to be representational of some idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever watch the DVD version where you can watch it in linear sequence?
No.
Yeah, the DVD deluxe version that I have, you can watch it in from front to back linear. And so it's super boring when you watch it that way.
Is it?
But I watched it that way when I first got the DVD, just because I wanted to put it all together in my head. And it was kind of interesting to see
interesting. What
the actual plot was.
Yeah. Huh.
But it's one of those movies, did you feel like you had to watch it again as soon as it was over?
Oh, yeah, dude. I remember when I first watched it. Because, again, I was, relatively young. At least we'll say intellectually young the first time I watched it. And I had no fucking clue what was going on. I got it, but then at the same time, I knew that I had missed so much. So I didn't rewatch it immediately then, but it was definitely one of those ones where you watch it and you're like, I've got to see that again. Whereas a lot of times you see a movie and there's a sense of release, you get that jouissance, whereas in Memento, I didn't. It was more of a stimulation.
Yeah, exactly. It definitely is to put it in a cliche, it makes you think.
Yeah,
100%. It engages and challenges you. And it's basically, I love when movies challenge you and say, I'm going to expect you to do some work here and not just sit back and be passive and receive stimulation. That's...
Yeah.
I love
exactly.
that.
All right, 2001.
2001, Spirited Away. That's my second Miyazaki film.
Yeah.
A beautiful, gorgeous movie. I mean, just like My Neighbor Totoro, it's an allegory for childhood. And coming of age and the whole kind of classic and cliche stuff. But it's brilliantly told. It's incredibly emotional and impactful. And the visuals are gorgeous. Yeah, it's just an amazing film.
Yeah, I've got to see some of his films then. Maybe I'll start with My Neighbor Totoro. Is that it?
I would start with Spirited Away.
And Spirited Away?
It's the most famous one for sure.
I'll have to check it out. He came out with one recently, a couple years ago, that was supposed to be his last, right?
Yeah, well, I think The Wind Also Rises was supposed to be his last.
That's the one, yeah.
I think he recently said he's coming back, though.
Oh, did he? Okay.
He can't stay away, man. He's like Michael Jordan.
Yeah. All right. 2001, Mulholland Drive.
Oh, I need to watch this again. I haven't seen it since it first came out, and it mind-fucked me with the lesbian stuff. I was too young. And I just got turned off from it, so I think I need to watch it again.
Yeah, you do. It's a great film. I mean, are you a Lynch fan more generally?
Yeah, I mean, generally.
Yeah, yeah. It's it's a mind fuck. All of his films are a mind fuck. But yeah, Mulholland Drive, 2001.
Is that your favorite Lynch film?
No, I don't think so. Well. No, I think Blue
Velvet. Lost Highway is another big one, right?
Lost Highway, Blue Velvet,
Eraserhead.
I don't know if it is my favorite of his films, but it's my favorite from that year. That's for sure.
And it's not a film, but I can't wait for Twin Peaks to come back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That'll be legit.
Love me some Agent Cooper. 2002 is Charlie Kaufman's adaptation.
Oh, God. I almost
can't believe I have a Nicolas Cage film in here, but I adore this movie. And it's about a screenwriter, so of course you would have to love this, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's Charlie Kaufman, so it's ironic and it's sarcastic and it's surrealistic and it's incredibly comic and great. Great turn by what's her name? A famous blonde actress who hates Trump. Oh, my God. has every Academy Award known to man.
Oh, Meryl Streep.
Blanking. Yeah, Meryl Streep, yeah. Yeah, great, fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's a great fucking movie. I almost chose it, actually, but I didn't because I decided to go with a small independent film that... Now, this is 2002. I had just graduated high school, and I was working in Hollywood... auditioning a lot and doing commercials and taking acting classes. And so I was really interested in acting performances. I go through different phases. I like films for different reasons. And this was a phase when I was liking films primarily for acting reasons in 2002. And it was a young actor by the name of Ryan Gosling who starred in a film called The Believer, where he plays a Jewish neo-Nazi. And it was fantastic. He's a Jew, but he's a self-hating Jew, and he actually holds to anti-Semitic and neo-Nazi beliefs, and he actually plots to blow up synagogues and shit. And it was a fantastic performance from him. And more than just that, it's a pretty simple but well-directed film by Henry Bean. So, The Believer.
How old was he in that film?
In 2002? I mean, thinking like 15 20? Years ago. Well, I mean, he's what, 15 years ago? So, yeah, 20? Something like that?
I had no idea he was in stuff back then.
That was the one that really launched him because it was the indie darling.
I didn't see that then.
Yep.
2003, for me, is Chan-Wook Park's Old Boy.
Huh.
Do you not like Old Boy?
No, I just have it on a different year.
You have it on a different year?
Yeah.
What year do you have it on? 2004?
2005.
What?
Well, maybe did it come out?
Maybe there was a U.S. release date that's different.
Maybe there was a U.S. release date in 2005.
And the Korean one. We'll check on that later.
Okay.
But that counts as five.
Does it? It does.
Maybe.
It does.
Sort of.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
there's controversy now.
Yeah, that's right. There's got to be controversy. There's always controversy.
But Old Boy is great. I mean,
yeah.
Visually, it's, I mean, talk about grabbing you in with the plot.
Mm.
Guy gets kidnapped for 15 years, no idea why. And it's got that great, just ridiculous South Korean horror premise to it, which would like never work in an American film because it's too out there.
Yeah, they tried. They did try, remember?
Spike Lee tried. That movie was bad for other reasons than just that. But I remember first watching that movie in college and just being floored by it.
Yeah.
And the one scene where he fights like 50 guys into one long shot.
Yeah.
And he's got a knife in his back in the middle of it. Oh yeah, that was, that blows you away.
The reason that scene was so amazing was because we're so accustomed to action films where, you know, Jason Bourne gets hit 50,000 times and he gets up and he doesn't really get phased. This looked pretty much like this is what would happen if you did take on 50 guys. Now, of course, there's obviously some movie magic, but at least he gets the shit kicked out of him and he's beat up and there's a little bit more of a material reality to the hits.
Yeah, I guess the guy who plays Daisu is a pretty famous South Korean actor.
Okay.
And so there was a lot of, for people who are veterans of South Korean film, I guess it was a pretty awesome experience to see him like play this role where he gets the shit kicked out of him and all this.
Hmm. Hmm. Yeah.
I guess it'd be like if George Clooney was doing this for us, something like that. That would be pretty impressive.
Yeah, see, I always admire when actors aren't afraid to get dirty. And I mean that because, you know, a lot of times they want to look good or they want the light to hit them right. But I love it when an actor just says, fuck it, that's not the point, man. Let's just be true to what's going on and let's get gritty and nasty. I love that. That's beautiful.
What do you have for 2003 then?
Dogville by Lars von Trier.
Oh.
This might be my favorite von Trier film. I got so obsessed with it that I actually watched Dogville multiple times and then I watched the documentary about the making of Dogville multiple times. I think it's absolutely fantastic.
It's Nicole Kidman and it's set in like a weird stage.
It's a soundstage,
right?
Yeah, it's basically Nicole Kidman, Paul Bettany, Stellan Skarsgård, Lauren Bacall, and it's on this soundstage that basically it looks like a large theater stage, let's say, and all of the buildings in this town, because it takes place in this town, Nicole Kidman's on the run and, you know, she comes into this town and you know, there's a protection and then there's a romance and shit like that. But the thing that's really interesting is formally the stage doesn't have a set in the proper sense. It has basically paint outlines of buildings and doors and bookshelves and the place where a stove would be or where your bed would be. And so people knock on non-existent doors because it's a wall that's painted on the ground. And so but you can see everything that's going on. So there's constantly action and there are these overhead shots that are always moving. And it's just a very interesting way to set a film. And I love von Trier generally, but this particular one, for some reason, gripped me and has still gripped me.
I'll have to say that. I think it's like 3.5 hours long, right? It's super long.
Yeah.
And I watched it when I was 18 and I quit like a third of the way through and said, this is stupid. So I need to watch it again, obviously.
Yeah.
2004 is, for me, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
I almost chose it, man.
Almost. I don't know how you couldn't choose it. I mean, this has got to be like, this is one of those you put in the time capsule for the aliens to get once we destroy ourselves.
Mm.
Like, this is one of our greatest artistic achievements. Like, it's not one of my all-time favorite films, as in, like, top five or anything. But just as far as a great, an acknowledged a movie to be great in basically every facet, the writing, cinematography, acting, everything.
Yeah.
And it's philosophically deep and it's emotionally deep. Like, it doesn't sacrifice anything for some particular purpose. It's just great on all levels.
Now, do you pretty much just like everything that Charlie Kaufman does?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't as huge on Anomalisa, his last film.
Okay.
I thought it was good, but it was so incredibly dark and sardonic that I couldn't quite take it. But yeah, before that, everything he's done I've loved.
Yeah, see, I like Anomalisa a lot, and I didn't love Synecdoche, New York.
I was positive on Synecdoche, but not as much as Adaptation and Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah, Eternal Sunshine is my favorite Kaufman film.
I love the idea of Synecdoche, though, of him building out this whole play. Like, the philosophical kind of idea of it was great. And Philip Seymour Hoffman is fantastic in it.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably a little bit more conceptually great than practically great. Whereas Eternal Sunshine is 100% of both.
Exactly, across the board. It's, you know, the other podcast that I do with Keir, one of the things that he always gets frustrated with me about is a lot of times the films that I enjoy are conceptual or formal rather than being narratively driven. And this is one of those films that straddles both. It's formally interesting, it's conceptually interesting, but at the same time, there is a lovely narrative. There is a story. You care. You empathize with protagonists in the traditional dramatic sense. And so, yeah, it's a great film. Fucking great film. And Jim Carrey. Also, who thought that he could act like that?
It's a movie where we found out Jim Carrey could act.
Jesus, man. This and The Majestic and Truman Show. I remember when he did those three films, it was kind of like, oh, this guy could be a serious actor. And then he kind of started doing weird-ass shit. Like the number 23 or whatever.
Yeah, the fuck is wrong with him?
I don't know.
What do you have for 04?
Primer by Shane Carruth.
Oh, yeah. That was a close one for me. I love Primer. Do you understand it?
No, of course not. What are you fucking talking about? I don't understand that. I don't understand Upstream Color. I don't understand Shane Carruth. But I know he's doing something interesting. And I love him.
Yeah, great films, though.
Fucking brilliant. Yeah, and that, to me, is worthwhile. Even if I don't fully follow, even if there are things that I don't always agree with, if you're going big and you're doing it on a limited budget. I mean, he wrote the film, he produced the film, he directed the film, he stars in the film, he composed the music for the film, he edited the film.
For like 20 bucks, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think for, you know, $10,000, $15,000, something like that. So, yeah, fan-fucking-tastic.
Yeah, you know you're going to be a friend with somebody if you show them Primer, and they go, I have no fucking idea what's happening, but that's the point.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you need to be drawn into the chaos of the timeline. Like, if you feel like you're following it, then there's something wrong with you or wrong with the way you're experiencing the movie.
Yeah. All right, 05.
05 is actually my second documentary. I forgot about this one. Grizzly Man.
Oh, yeah. Good movie.
Grizzly Man, Werner Herzog's film. It's my favorite Werner Herzog film. It was the first one I ever saw of his. And the way he addressed the emotional and philosophical depths of a crazy guy who wants to go and, like, just be with bears all the time. And the fact that he didn't romanticize it and celebrate it, but he found it worth diving deep into.
Mm.
And, of course, the baritone Werner Herzog narration is just so – you can lull you to sleep and
timeless.
Everything. It's great.
Yeah, I think I love – Werner Herzog, because I liken him oftentimes to a child who is exploring the world phenomenologically. So he perpetually lives in the Husserlian epoche, you know, that he just brackets the assumptions of lived experience, and he is always living in phenomenological reduction. And that's how he functions, but he does it with a camera in his hand. And I watched a Q&A with him after his last film, Lo and Behold. And at the Q&A, he was saying, you know, if Elon Musk offered him a ticket to Mars, he said, of course I will go if I can bring a camera. And again, that's the way that he experiences the world. That's why he's so prolific. He had two documentaries and a feature film come out in the last 365 days. So
a documentary. He's like a million years old, yeah.
Yeah, and he's old as fuck. So it's just so interesting because he just has that childlike perspective on the world where he's learning and he's exploring. I think it was – is it at the end of Grizzly Man where there's like the albino alligators? What film is that?
I don't remember that.
There's some fun. Oh no, no. It's the cave one.
Okay, Forgotten Dreams or whatever.
Yeah, I think at the very end of it's that one. At the very end, there are these fucking albino alligators, and they have nothing to do with anything except he starts like musing in his narration. He's like, "I wonder what these alligators thought of these cave paintings." It's like, what? And the reason he shot them is because he had already shot his film. His story was done. But then he saw these cool albino alligators and he wanted to explore them and film them. It's the most amazing thing. He just lives in that state of epoche, and I think it's beautiful. I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, you know you're a great filmmaker when you like are so – you're on the edge of self-parody at almost every moment.
Mm.
But it's totally okay for you to do it and no one else could.
Mm-hmm.
It's just his style.
Yep. All right. My 2005 was Old Boy, so we can just move past that because we already talked about it. So okay. 2006.
2006 for me is Children of Men.
Ooh.
Which – it's Alfonso Cuarón, right, I believe, his film. And, I mean, even just, it didn't do that well, and it doesn't have the stature that I think it really should, given that politically, it probably the most sort of depthful, accurate portrayal of, you know, post-2001 political climate in the West of basically any movie. I mean, the way that it portrays all this chaos happening sort of in the background of Clive Owen's story.
Yeah.
And it is brilliant and one of a kind, and it's obviously shot amazing.
Yeah,
and
there's
the one car chase scene.
Oh, that was just going to say the camera where it's like, what is it, 360 degrees or some shit? The way the camera flows in and out of that car and
If you do one thing, watch the YouTube video that's the part of the documentary on how they shot that scene. It's incredible.
Yeah.
The work they had to do to put into it.
Yeah, fantastic movie. It'd probably be in my top three from that year, but my number one was Pan's Labyrinth.
That was my battle.
Yeah.
That's also a top like 20 movie of all time for me.
Yeah.
I adore Pan's Labyrinth.
It's amazing. It's one of my favorite films of all time. And I think that was when, in 2006, I was 23. And I think I probably had just started thinking about things at a more academic level because I was a late starter. You know, I didn't go back to school till I was 21, 22. I was just about 22, so I was 22 really. And I saw this film around then and this idea of magical realism. But I think I actually saw it in 2007. I'll be honest, I believe you may have recommended this film to me. I don't know, but when we were an undergrad. And it's beautiful. It's impactful. It's politically interesting, dealing with Franco's Spain. And I just think it's a fantastic film.
So. Yeah, the way that it hits all those buttons, right? It's politically subversive. It also has the magical realism aspect. And it uses that allegorically to talk about this emotional experience of the young girl, right? I mean, it hits all those buttons in a way movies just can't do.
Yeah.
It seems like most of the time.
Yep, yep.
2007 is... for me, No Country of Old Men. I think the only Best Picture winner I have on this entire list. I'm pretty sure.
No Country for Old Men.
No Country for Old Men, yeah.
Oh, you said of. You said of.
Oh, No Country for Old Men.
Yes.
I mean, what do you say about this movie? It's philosophically interesting, dealing with morality.
Mm-hmm.
Anton Chigurh, he's a classic all-time villain character, right? Walking around with a cattle prod. Tommy Lee Jones gives a bravado understated performance that gives the depth needed to the film. And the end of it is just dark as fuck.
I remember the blog that we used to run back in the day. You actually wrote a review of it or a sort of philosophical analysis of the film.
Oh God, I'm sure that's horrible.
We should find it. Google it. Google it.
Oh my God. That's going to be embarrassing.
Yeah.
This is like 19, 20 year old me. So, yeah.
All right, my 2007 film was There Will Be Blood. So I'm not always a huge PTA fan. I like a lot of his stuff, but I don't love his stuff. Like, you know, Punch Drunk Love is good. Boogie Nights is good. He does good work. But I don't love him like I feel like I should love him as someone who is involved in the film industry, you know? But this film, for some reason, really got me. And I don't know why, but there was something so stripped down about that weird soundtrack.
Johnny Greenwood did that.
Yeah, that it just gets in there, you know? And of course, Daniel Day-Lewis is the big over-the-top performance, but it works
in
this.
I drink your milkshake! That was a meme for like 2 years.
It was also in the reboot of Gilmore Girls. They have like this crew of millennials that sit around and they have a I drink your milkshake day where they go and to honor Paul Thomas Anderson, they go to a milkshake place and they share a milkshake. And before they do it, they're like, I drink your milkshake or whatever it is together. So it's a fantastic movie. I absolutely love it. And I think in this instance, it's one of Daniel Day-Lewis's big performances that I think actually is perfect. So Gangs of New York is a little over the top. Lincoln's good, but you know, I feel like he's being a little bit self-indulgent. And even though he's totally self-indulgent in this film, for some reason it just works.
It's supposed to be over the top. It's fitting to the whole affectation of the movie.
Yeah, exactly, because he is a larger than life figure, so it's fitting that he would be a larger than life character.
Yeah, very much so. 2008 for me is the Swedish movie Let the Right One In.
Oh yeah.
Which is probably my favorite horror movie. The American remake was meh, as they always are, but the original Swedish film is gorgeous. It's just beautifully shot. The acting is very understated in a very Swedish way, which is perfect for the film. And I remember I was living in Scotland when I saw this, watching it on my laptop by myself when it was in the middle of winter. And that setting probably also impacted me as well. The experience of the whole film. And just the ending was very philosophically interesting as well for me. So that's why I think it had such an impact.
Yeah, my 2008 film is The Dark Knight. And it was because this was a sort of reintroduction for me to superhero films, because I didn't see Batman Begins. I mean, I did, but I didn't really pay attention to it. Like, I don't have any recollection of my first time. I went back and I watched Batman Begins after The Dark Knight, but this film sort of brought the superhero genre back to me in a way that also resonated with my new burgeoning intellectual pursuits. And so the film was so important for me at that moment to help me think through various philosophical, political, social concepts, but that also fit within the context of something that resonated with the childhood me.
Yeah, I'll agree that when The Dark Knight came out and I saw it, I thought it was one of the greatest movies I'd ever seen. And just because of where I was at the time intellectually and everything, it was a popular movie, but also had more depth to it than other popular movies did, or at least tried to. I don't think I like it as much now as I did then, although I still do enjoy it. For a time period, that was certainly a really impactful movie. And of course, I mean, it goes unstated, but Heath Ledger's performance is like rapturing. Yeah, every time he's on the screen, amazing. You're like, you forget you're watching a movie.
Yeah, it's amazing. All right, 2009.
For me is Coen Brothers again, A Serious Man.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
Which is, I mean, I show this movie in my world religions classes when we're studying Judaism, just because it throws them for a loop to see this depiction of Judaism, and because I think it gets to some philosophical issues at the heart of kind of modern Judaism. And so I've seen this a number of times now and kind of critically analyzed it with students and everything, and it becomes so rich. Every time you watch it, I feel like I'm picking up new subtle things, which is very Coen Brothers. Way of experiencing films. You're always going to experience something new about the film when you watch it again.
And now, isn't this an adaptation of Job, the story of Job?
Yeah, I mean, very loosely. And they use it for their own purposes, but it's got that same theme, which of course I love talking about with students. And the ending just sends chills up your spine, which is always great.
All right, my 2009 film is Sin Nombre. Cary Fukunaga's film about a...
I haven't seen this.
Yeah, it's about a Honduran girl trying to immigrate to the U.S. and a young boy who is caught up in the violence of gang life, who also wants to escape. And I believe it was his directorial debut. I think it's his first feature film. And it's absolutely fantastic. So, I mean, obviously people think of him for other reasons now, especially more recently in the last couple of years with True Detective. And then, of course, he did Beasts of No Nation. But this was the film that really put him on the map.
I'm going to have a list of movies to watch now because of you.
I know. Well, same.
2010, this is a guilty pleasure for me. Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
That's a good movie, dude.
I love this movie. It gets some shit from people for being too cute or whatever. Mm. It's like the most fun movie ever. I mean, it's because I can remember seeing it for the first time and just completely forgetting everything about the world other than the movie. And that experience is pretty rare for me. So when it happens, I have an affection for a movie.
Right.
And just the whole video game feel of it was so fun, and the acting, and the humor is right in my wheelhouse. I totally fell in love with what's her name, Mary Elizabeth Winstead's character.
Oh yes, yeah.
In it, I'm not a huge fan of what's his name,
Michael Cera.
Yeah, Michael Cera. Yeah. At all, but yeah, he's perfect for that role.
Yeah, I mean the cast is kind of amazing too if you think about who's in it. So let me just read this off. It's Michael Cera, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Kieran Culkin, Chris Evans, who's one of the exes.
One of those vegan douchebags.
Yeah.
One of the exes, yeah.
Anna Kendrick.
Yeah, his sister.
Brie Larson.
Oh, I forgot she was in it.
Yeah. Allison Pill. She's
the main
ex. Yeah.
The drummer, yeah.
Brandon Routh and Jason Schwartzman.
Jason Schwartzman's so good.
He's so good.
In that role.
So, I know, man. It's crazy to think of all the people in it. And not only that, but it is masterfully directed by Edgar Wright. He is so good. I can't remember. I think the YouTube series is called Every Frame a Picture. And it's a guy who basically talks about the intricacies of various different filmmakers and what makes them interesting. So why is every frame a picture? I think that's what it's called, Every Frame a Picture. And he does one on Edgar Wright and how the sort of typical person, the way that they would do editing or the way that they would cut or the way that they would direct a scene of people at a bar is this way when someone gets a drink. But the way Edgar Wright does it is this way. And it's much more colorful. It's much more unique. It's much more affective because he's actually an artist with every frame of his film, his films, plural. And it kind of makes you have even a greater appreciation for what Edgar Wright does after watching this little YouTube video. It's a 10 or 12 minute video. Definitely check it out.
I'll definitely check that out.
Yeah.
What do you have for 2010?
Blue Valentine. Complete opposite feel.
Wow, exact opposite.
I know. It was the first Derek C. in France film that I saw. I didn't see his earlier films until after, or earlier film until afterwards. But I think that he is one of the most interesting filmmakers that we have in independent cinema in America. And it's, God, man. I mean, when you talk about a film that will affect you, this film will do it. Kind of like Manchester by the Sea did. It's got a very similar tone to it. And of course, Michelle Williams is fantastic in both. But
yeah,
she, I see, and I grew up with her as Jen from Dawson's Creek. So to see her play this role was so interesting to me. And I've got a huge man crush on Ryan Gosling. I actually think he's an underutilized actor. I don't want to say understated, but I think he's underutilized because I think a lot of times because he's very good looking and he has a commanding presence, he isn't oftentimes given the types of roles that I think always make him shine. Even though I think sometimes he does, a lot of times he does, you know, and his two films that he did with C in France both did that, obviously, you know, Place Beyond the Pines is phenomenal. Even though he obviously is not in the whole movie, but I think he has a depth to him that we don't always see. And I think it comes out sometimes, and in Blue Valentine, it's on full display. And so the acting is, the performance is amazing. The direction is subtle and understated, but I think brilliant. And then the story is just hit you straight in the motherfucking heart.
Yeah, absolutely. 2011, speaking of Ryan Gosling, is Drive.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Nick Reffin's Drive. I remember seeing this movie and having no idea who this guy was who was making it. What is he? Is he Finnish?
He is Danish.
Oh, Danish. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Because he did those movies with Matt Nicholson.
Yeah, the Valhalla Rising films.
Yeah, and Drive was just – I mean, the opening scene when he's driving around and the Clippers game is going on in the background – I was just like, I love this movie, man. Automatically, the first 5 minutes, I knew that I'm going to love this movie. And dude, it's like, there's bouts of ultra violence, and then it's understated for like, you know, 30 minutes straight. Mm. And, oh yeah, just...
The soundtrack is brilliant. The pink lipstick writing is amazing. It's got this weird nostalgia, like an 80s nostalgia feel, but set in the late, you know, the knots. Well, I guess it's not the knots because it's 2011, right? So it's got a weird retro vibe, but it's also like very
meta nostalgia though. Because it's not trying to like say, oh, I wish there was that time where times were better then, but it's just going to be set in artistically into this frame.
Yeah, there were two films that I saw around the same time in 11 and 12 that where I almost wrote like an essay on it about how the real main character is the cityscape. And it was Los Angeles in Drive, and it was New York City in Shame. And
oh, yeah.
And it was really interesting, but for some reason, those films, they just struck me that the real character, the real protagonist, if you will, almost, is the city as the material condition out of which all of the praxis emerges. And yeah, fuck, Drive's fantastic. But it wasn't my 2011 film. My 2011 film was actually a film that the first time I saw it, I actually walked out of it because I thought it was pretentious and overindulgent and ridiculous. And then I watched it a second time and I said, oh my God, I must have been high, or maybe I wasn't high and that was the problem, but it's Lars von Trier's Melancholia. See, I think part of the reason was I had such high expectations. And then I saw this and I was like, what, this guy, and maybe I was like hungover or something. I remember I saw it with my friend Natalie in Dundee and I think we both walked out. We looked at each other and we were like, yeah, we're fucking over this. And we walked out and on repeated viewings now, I wonder what the fuck was going through my mind because I think it's one of the most amazing films I've ever seen.
I still haven't seen it.
You haven't?
Oh, dude. I know. I have it, believe it or not, but I still haven't. It's hard. It's hard a movie to actually like, make yourself sit down and watch.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's like Blue Valentine. It's like, am I in the mood to get like utterly depressed? No. So, all right, 2012, brother.
2012 for me is, speaking of Mads Mikkelsen, The Hunt. Which is a movie about Mads Mikkelsen is a kindergarten or elementary school teacher.
Yeah.
And he's accused by a female student who wants to kiss him, basically, very innocently, and he refuses, tells her that it's not okay. She accuses him of being inappropriate with her, not really maliciously, but just because she's angry.
Well, she's just angry. And then the teacher, the head teacher, starts
kind of
feeding her.
It that way.
Yeah, and yeah. She starts saying, did he do this? And she starts leading. And then the little girl just starts nodding just simply because she wants to get him in trouble. So
yeah, it's very much a film about how easily language and intentions can be obscured in certain sort of social conditions.
Yeah.
And how suggestible individuals are. Everyone, from kids to adults, everyone's in the same boat.
Yeah.
And just the creep up your spine as you see the way he's isolated from society is the most uncomfortable feeling I think I've ever had in a film.
Yeah.
I mean, I wanted to turn it off at every moment, but I couldn't because it was so enthralling.
Yeah.
And the ending was appropriately ambiguous, which I really appreciated as well. It didn't wrap it up into a neat bow. It was like, this shit like happens. Deal with it.
Yeah. My 2012 film was Thomas Vinterberg's The Hunt. It's one of my favorite films of all time. That film, oh my God. Okay, acting performance. First of all, Mads Mikkelsen did win the Best Actor Award at Cannes. He should have won it at the Oscars, but you never give foreign films Best Actor, unfortunately. He should have. His performance is stellar. That's the pinnacle. That's what acting is. That's what it should be. The direction, the story, the tension. Oh my God, it's fucking brilliant, man. Across the board. So one of my friends and I have had this theory, and I want to explore it further at some point in my life, but we actually think that foreign acting tends to be better on the average. And we don't think it's just simply, or he doesn't necessarily think this, but I don't think it's just simply down to training, but I also think it has to do with language. I think the English language makes us think and makes us act and makes us perform in particular ways. I also think that there are obviously Hollywood elements that influence the superficiality of acting, and so there isn't the same type of training that you get maybe in other acting schools around the world. But I think that there's something about other languages that I think would be an interesting way to explore it, because across the board, acting in foreign countries is really fucking good, except like Bollywood stuff, which can be kind of campy and cheesy and over the top.
Is there a selection bias here, dude, where like we're only thinking about the movies that are the best? We're not seeing all the shitty
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, even things like The Killing, and if you watch, South Korean cinema, if you watch Nigerian cinema, yeah, some of it is bad. But there's something about, I think, the English language that just fucks with people. I don't know, man. And maybe it's bigger than that. I'm sure it also has to do with other structural things. But I do wonder if there's something linguistically about acting. Because fuck, man, there's not a single weak spot in The Hunt. Even the little girl. She's fucking 5 years old, and she's fantastic. I know,
right? So good.
What the fuck, man?
You should write a paper on this, and the linguistic determinists out there are going to just eat it all up.
Yeah, I know. I don't know exactly the road that I would take, but for some reason, it's been bouncing around in my mind for years. All right, 2013.
2013 is Spike Jonze's Her.
You know what's funny? I've still never seen it.
What? Are you serious?
I'm serious. I've still never seen it.
I mean, that surprises me. You would love this film. Oh, my God. It's got you written all over it.
Oh, really?
Joaquin Phoenix, the plot is he falls in love with his operating system in the near future, which is basically an artificial intelligence. And it's voiced by Scarlett Johansson, which obviously sucks me right in. And it's funny and dramatic and hits all the Spike Jonze buttons that you would expect. But then also so poignant. Of a sort of exploration of infatuation and love, and I mean it's one of those movies you could, when you come out of it, you have to talk about it with everyone that's seen it, and it gets annoying at times, I'm sure, but if it's that kind of movie, obviously I'm gonna fall in love with it. And I went to a screening at my college that I teach at of the movie and talked about it with students, and that was a great experience as well, because anybody will love talking about this film because everybody experiences infatuation and wants to talk about it. So it's a universal experience. It's pretty rare to have a philosophical type movie that's universal like that.
Yeah, I got to see it. It's on my list, and it's just one of those. You know how your lists keep growing and then you forget things that are on your list? Like, I forgot that I know, it was right? on my list, but it's on my list. All right, my 2013 is The Spectacular Now, James Ponsoldt film starring Miles Teller and Shailene Woodley. Did you see The Spectacular Now?
Yeah, it's a really good movie.
This film, for some reason, I was obsessed with it for a little bit. I think I watched it like 4 or 5 times within the span of a couple of weeks. There are just certain films that have done that. And I'm surprised I didn't put this film, but there was another film, like Zombieland, had that effect on me. You know, I don't know why, but there was something – sometimes certain films, they just – I need to see them multiple times. I kind of almost become obsessed with the story, with the characters, with the feel, with the tone. And The Spectacular Now was this film for me. And it was my introduction to Miles Teller. And then, I've seen some of his earlier films since then. But – and of course, Shailene Woodley, she's just a dream in it. And they together – yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And it's a really – I'm a sucker for coming-of-age stories, which you'll also see in 2 years' time. Actually, the next three films are kind of similarly related. But I'm a sucker for coming-of-age stories. And during certain times of my life, for some reason, they really speak to me. And for whatever reason, my 2013, 2014, and 2015, and 2016 film actually all kind of are in a similar sort of vein of kind of emergence and growth in life. So I fucking love The Spectacular Now. One of my favorite films of all time.
Oh, wow, yeah. 2014 for me is Wes Anderson's Grand Budapest Hotel.
Oh, great movie.
It's my favorite Wes Anderson film. It's just, it's beautiful. I could watch Jeff Goldblum doing his thing in that film all day, every day, and never be tired.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is Wes Anderson's best film.
Yeah.
100%. 100%. That's fucking fantastic. I mean, they were talking about that film winning Best Oscar. You know? So, obviously it didn't, but I mean, there were rumbles.
That would have been one of a kind.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right, my 14 film is Whiplash. Speaking of Miles Teller, again, 2014, I had moved back to Los Angeles. So I was living back in Los Angeles when I saw this film, and I was immersed in the film industry up to my eyeballs. And for whatever reason, I mean, there were mutual friends that knew producers on the film. And so, you know, I got to see it at a screening that was kind of an intimate sort of situation. And it was the performance. It was It was really the performance thing. Like I said, remember I go through different phases where sometimes I like a film for different reasons. Really, it was about the acting. It was the story and the simplicity of just a person and another person and the tensions and dramas that they have to try to reconcile. And the way that it's done in this film, I just think was absolutely amazing. So, fan-fucking-tastic film.
2015, Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, yeah, it's a great film.
I mean, this is up there. This might be the best action film ever made.
Yeah, it's amazing.
But up there with Terminator 2 and Die Hard. It's, I mean, just watch the, if anything, watch the documentary on YouTube about the making of the film and all the practical effects and everything that went into it. It's amazing. It's beautifully shot. I mean, it's, you feel like you're in a car in the middle of the of the long chase and throughout the entire movie. It's just like rocking you back and forth and never stops.
Yeah.
It's like the urtext of action films, right? Like it has to be, this is, if you want to make an action film, watch this before you do so.
It is easily the greatest action film of all time. I mean, I know some people say The Raid or The Raid 2. No, they're great. This film does something, it does it on a completely different level. But my favorite film of 2015, another coming of age story, super, super indie darling Sundance film, Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl.
Oh, I love that movie so much.
Dude, the scene, I don't want to give away too much, but the scene in the hospital when he's playing the movie and there's that song.
Bawling.
Bro. Every time. I've seen the film like 3 or 4 times now. I remember when I saw it in the movie theater, I'm not talking like little tears. I was literally like crying. I wasn't like just teary-eyed, bro. Like I was fucking crying, man. Oh my God. And that song, whenever I hear that fucking song, they use it so often. I don't even think about it in context. I think about it, it takes me back to that scene. Fuck, man. That movie. Oh, I love that movie.
that movie is like the dude with the frilly hair and the cardigan. And then all of a sudden you say something wrong to him and he just all of a sudden like brings out the jujitsu and beats the shit out of you. And you have no idea where it came from. It's like that in movie form. Like it's so indie and like
twee,
you know, wry and twee and all that. And then it just kicks you in the nuts with emotions at the end.
Oh my God, so good. And John Bernthal is fucking amazing in everything he does. Can we just say the Punisher as a school teacher is fucking perfect? So
yeah, absolutely.
Goddamn. All right, and then 2016.
2016 for me is Passengers. Really? I just saw that last night, and it was such a poignant movie about relationships, and I'm just kidding. It was a god-awful movie. Oh, my God, I can't believe that.
Was it bad? Okay.
It was, like, the most rapey, non-Beauty and the Beast film I think I've ever seen. No, my 2016 movie is Midnight Special. You talked about
that's right,
year-end podcast, and I'm not going to belabor it, but I just I loved the take on – it was sci-fi, but then it's really this allegory for having a child and a child that's ill and possibly losing the child. It's just, I love the allegory in general, obviously, as you can tell from my previous films. And so that really affected me more than any film last year.
Hmm. Yeah, my 2016 film, we talked about it, was Sing Street, another coming-of-age story, but I think it's absolutely amazing. So Sing, motherfucking Street. Now, what about your 2017 film? Is it Beauty and the Beast so far?
2017 film's Get Out, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's going to be. There's almost no way any movie's going to pass that. It was that good.
Yeah, I can see that.
What is
yours? Man. Yeah, I mean, I've only seen 2 films in the theater, I think, this year. Wait, have I? I don't even know what I've fucking seen in the theater this year. I haven't thought about it. But the films that I've seen recently in the theater, yeah, Get Out, for sure. It'll be my favorite film that I've seen. The only problem was I saw it with a bunch of Irish people, and I don't think they got a lot of the inside jokes, like the bit where she's searching for her next boyfriend.
The NCAA.
And the NCAA. I started laughing so loud, and I don't think anybody else got that. I was like, oh, you guys don't even know what the fuck NCAA is.
Yeah, that was great. There's been so many memes about that during the tournament. It's been pretty great.
Has there? Yeah.
Anytime someone has a major dunk, they always show the picture of her Googling him.
Watch out, Lonzo. She's coming for you, brother. You better tell your dad, LeVar, to fucking up his game because fucking she's coming.
I don't know, Matt. He's too mixed for her, I would think. But
that's true.
That's true. That's our favorite movie every year since we were born.
Jesus, man.
Can't believe it. That's a lot.
That's a lot. You know what I wonder too? I wonder how many of those aren't actually my favorite from that year. Like if I had like hours to look through the entire annal of film history, the annals of film history, would I modify some of my choices?
Yeah, there's a couple you mentioned that I didn't think about and that I'm now questioning a few.
Yeah.
My choices.
Yeah. But that's all right.
All right, well, anyway, our next segment is the Sticky Leaves, where one of us talks about what's bringing us meaning in a relatively meaningless world. Austin, what do you have for us this week?
All right, so my Sticky Leaves this week is a book that I started reading. It's a book called Creating Freedom, The Lottery of Birth, The Illusion of Consent, and The Fight for Our Future by Raul Martinez. Now, he, I don't believe, was trained in philosophy. But the book is basically a sort of compatibilist reading of freedom. So he talks a lot about brain chemistry. He talks a lot about cultural conditioning and why it is that we need to completely then discard the sort of voluntarist notions or the libertarian notions of freedom that we find so often that kind of condition our economic, political, and social rhetoric. And so he talks about what this will do is it'll help us to actually develop empathy, and it'll help us to come up with alternative forms of justice rather than just simply punitive. It would be restorative, because if you start to realize that you aren't actually ultimately responsible for all of your actions, then we need to have a different tack for how it is that we seek to address the things that we do or the things that we don't do or are certain proclivities. And it's really well written. And I think the reason that I like it is because it isn't a book of philosophy. It's a book of popular nonfiction. And so that's why I want to talk about it in my Sticky Leaves, because I think a lot of times, you know, philosophical works like this can be a little bit obtuse, whereas this is definitely something that's accessible and it's relatively enjoyable. You know, it's not like reading a Matt Taibbi book or something like that. It's not humorous thus far, but it's at least well written and it flows and it's a quick read. And at the same time, he's dealing with some, you know, pretty interesting philosophical concepts that I think, you know, obviously you and I have talked about the relationships of philosophy, and we studied in our undergrad the ideas of freedom and determinism and things like that. So, you know, it fits really well kind of within the sort of philosophical, a more properly philosophical paradigm. And I think I'm enjoying it so far.
That sounds interesting, especially from that perspective of writing about that subject.
It would be
interesting to read.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it makes me think I'd like to see more of this. As I'm reading it, it makes me think, God, I wish that I were better at disseminating hard philosophical concepts in a way that I could reach out to people. You know, I mean, like you and I have talked about all kinds of different book ideas in the past, and it's something that I would like to learn it's a skill that I would like to cultivate to a greater degree moving forward, is to be able to communicate these really interesting, deep philosophical themes in a way that I think would also, you know, be able to be consumed for a larger audience rather than just a bunch of academics sitting in their office that are jockeying for tenure or something.
Yeah, fuck that, man.
Exactly. So check it out, Creating Freedom by Raul Martinez. I just got a Kindle version. I know so many people, they like hardback or hard copy versions. Fuck it, this is a Kindle book for sure, or an audiobook. Audiobook that shit or Kindle that shit, and you'll be able to fly through it. But it's pretty good. So yeah, check that shit.
Speaking of for a larger audience, for our bullshitting segment, which is where we talk about something that either doesn't matter or we don't know anything about, we have this new series of Clinton appearing on season finales of every show on television coming up for her victory tour.
Yeah.
So she was on the season finale of Girls last week, and I was pretty impressed with her saving everybody from a fiery bus crash.
Yeah, and her pantsuit was unwrinkled. She looked great afterwards. You know, her little hair situation that she's got going on was still intact. I don't know how they do that, but, you know, she's kind of a female Jason Bourne in a pantsuit.
Yeah, the fact that she could show no emotion after the intense flames of the bus crash and saving a bunch of people's lives was very impressive.
Yeah, and I'm curious to see how the writers of Girls Now are going to kind of create the story arc around this. Like, is this going to be a recurring role, or is this just a one-off? Was this just a special guest star?
Well, they're going to have 7 more opportunities.
I guess they have to, right?
With her in office, so it should work. Possibly more than 7. I mean, I'm not going to, things can happen.
Yeah.
We can only hope, right?
Yeah, that's true. So what else? Yeah.
It sounds like next she's going to be on, the rumor is she's going to be on The Walking Dead next.
Is she going to play a zombie, or what's she going to play?
Well, I don't think so, unless it's a heroic zombie. I'm pretty sure Hillary Clinton will kill Negan. That's my prediction.
Are you
watching The Walking Dead?
I am not caught up, dude. I am so far behind.
Negan's the worst character ever created for television.
Who's the actor?
Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Oh, yeah. I see, but I like Jeffrey Dean Morgan, too.
Yeah, I know, me too, but not here.
Not here?
The character's terrible.
Why is his character terrible?
They decided, what if we made a character so evil that all he did was evil stuff and all he said was evil stuff? But he's also charming and charismatic. It's a parody of every charming sociopath. And he carries around a nail bat, and the writing is terrible for his character. He's totally one note. There's no depth to him. And they introduce him in the beginning of the season in this horrific way where he kills a bunch of people. And then they're going to draw it out for like 16 episodes of him just doing the same shit over and over again. Like, it's just monotonous. Oh, my God.
Unless Madam President comes in and whacks that dude, right?
It'll all be worth it when Her Highness comes and just pantsuits the shit out of him.
Yeah, that's right.
She'll go up there like she did in the debates and just say, "Is this who you're voting for? Really?
That's right.
Negan?" And she'll court the moderate sociopaths.
That's right.
From the other side. That's right. And it will work.
Moderate normalization for the win. Well, okay. So then after The Walking Dead, what can we expect to see in the world of entertainment for Madam President?
What do you think she should be on next? What season finale should she be on?
Well, I'm kind of hoping that they do some sort of Aaron Sorkin behind the scenes, but a real life version one, you know, like they did with West Wing or Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, but like the real West Wing. Like, instead of doing Real Housewives of Orange County, it'll be like the Real House Husband of the White House, and it'll be about Bill's activities day to day in the White House. As
all the hijinks he gets into?
Yeah, all the hijinks he gets into and how she has to keep him in line, you know? I think that's what it should be.
Honestly, I can honestly say that sounds like it was made just for me.
Right? Me too. The ratings would go through the roof, man. And, I mean, considering that everybody loves Madam President, she could get the best screenwriter. She could get Aaron Sorkin to write it. You know?
Yeah, he would do anything for her. He is the court scribe.
Yeah, and if they needed some humor, Judd Apatow would be all up on that. He could do some humor.
We're just getting all the best people in America together, it feels like.
The best people. The best people in America.
I'm kind of hoping that she'll be on next season finale of Westworld.
Will she be the master architect? So, like, she is the one who even came up with the plan. She incepted Anthony Hopkins' mind and gave him the blueprints to even come up with anything at all.
Yeah, it turns out Anthony Hopkins the whole time was actually a robot.
He's a robot, that's right.
And he was set up by President Clinton.
Hey, anybody out there that has funding, contact Troy and I, because we have great ideas. We can just keep these flowing all day. So whoever the business development people are that are coming up with ideas, feel free to reach out to us. You can hire us for the WGA minimum, and we'll go ahead and write your shit for you.
I'm pretty sure ideas. There's that South Park episode where Al Gore plays Man Bear Pig and he has to save everyone at every moment.
Yeah.
It'd like be like a non-ironic version of that,
but with President robots. Clinton.
And robots.
Yeah. This is gold.
And
this is gold. One more. We got to come up with one more brilliant idea so that the producers can come knocking. What else are we going to do?
I mean, Game of Thrones is the obvious one, right?
Yeah.
Like Daenerys and Jon Snow and everybody will fight each other, and then the White Walkers come, and then Clinton just owns them all.
Riddle me this. Will she wear her pantsuit, or will she wear a more appropriate attire?
What attire would she wear? I don't know, but you know what I do know?
Hmm.
is that she wouldn't fight the White Walkers.
Mm.
She would have a grand negotiating, grand bargain strategy with them.
Mm.
And it would be peace for everybody in the end.
Diplomacy. That's the most important thing. Diplomacy.
And then we'll take those Northmen, those super predator Northmen up there, and make sure that they spend their appropriate time in jail for trying to destroy the Seven Kingdoms.
As would be fitting.
You know what I'm talking about?
Probably no.
Not, right?
I have no idea, but I can bullshit along with you. I told you, I have not been keeping up with Game of Thrones, so it's not one of my obsessions like it is yours. All right, well, as has become custom for wrapping up our episode, since Michael was, albeit deservedly, thrown into a gulag for being a Bernie bro, we're going to end our episode with a moment of silence.